From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we heard about right whales along the Georgia coast. For generations, that stretch of sea and marsh has been home to folks who've made their living on the water. A new project aims to trace the traditions and changes in small-scale fishing through firsthand accounts.
If y'all could just go out and see how we do this thing, you'd be amazed how we set the nets and how we bring them in. It's awesome.
Georgia Southern Anthropology Professor Jennifer Sweeney Tooks and University of Georgia Associate Director of Marine Extension Brian Flick are leading a team of anthropology students in fishing traditions and fishing futures, oral histories of commercial fishing in Georgia. And they're both joining us from Savannah. Welcome, and thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Good morning.
Brian, I'm going to start with you. Georgia has only about 100 miles of coastline. May seem far to people living inland in Atlanta or the mountains of North Georgia. So take us there. How important is that stretch of waterway to Georgia's economy?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, because even though we might only have 100 miles, we have one of the most extensive stances of salt marsh on the eastern seaboard. And these salt marshes for decades and generations, as you said, really have provided the necessary habitat to support a wide variety of fisheries. And of course, there's also our nearshore and offshore waters that has also contributed to this as well. So for given a small area, we're extremely fortunate here in Georgia to have such a productive coast that's well protected.
Well, it looks like about $1 billion in economic activity each year. What are they reeling in or netting?
So when we talk about our domestic commercial fisheries here, Georgia's probably historically been known for their shrimping, as well as trapping of blue crabs. But at one point, we were one of the biggest producers of oysters. And these days, we've seen switches to clam aquaculture, and there's a growing interest with oyster aquaculture as well. But we've also had fishermen that target a number of finfish, so whether that's whiting or when you go offshore, popular species like snapper or sea bass. Even these days we have jellyfish. So there's a variety of species that have helped sustain coastal communities for generations.
The state, as Jennifer says, fishing generates more than 10,000 jobs a year. How many people are full-time fishers?
So one thing about that number, you've got to separate both domestic versus the import. So in a place like Georgia, where Atlanta is such a huge metropolitan area, a lot of the seafood industry positions are supporting more imported products. But if you look at our domestic industry, you're probably only looking around, 1,000, 1,500 jobs. So it's significantly smaller. But again, economically, and as Jennifer will talk about culturally, that plays a huge role in our coast.
Well, let's get to some of the cultural extension there. Fishing is often a multi-generational business. Here's a piece from one of the oral histories you gathered from a man recalling going out on the water when he was 12.
So I got on the boat with him and his crew, and we worked no clocking it 24 hours a day. I was on the back deck all night long picking up shrimp with his crew. It was cold. It was like freezing to me.
Jennifer, is it likely that people were born into fishing and that's what they're expected to do?
What we heard from many of the people that we spoke with was that is indeed how it has been in the past. Sadly, what we are hearing, though, is that more and more fishers have been encouraging their children to go out of the industry, to go to college, look for jobs on the hill, as they call them. So we are seeing a large exodus of people from the industry. That being said, on one of the days that we did our interviews, we did, in fact, talk with three different generations of the same family who were shrimping.
What does on the hill mean? You mean dry land?
Off the water, yes.
Anywhere but
on the water, yeah. In fact, one person told us, I can't do that. My gills dry out.
Well, Jennifer, you and Brian worked with a group of anthropology students on the project. And oral history, that's one methodology for studying communities. How does it fit into the understanding of Georgia fishers?
You know, oral histories really gave us a chance to hear the stories that the fishing community thought we needed to hear. It's a way to ask open-ended questions, to listen to the stories, to the histories, to the experiences, and then to look for commonalities among those stories. That being said, these students were trained in anthropological methods, so they were definitely using open-ended ethnographic questioning and follow-ups, doing it in a very anthropological style, but really sitting back and letting the fishers guide, for the most part, the topics that they explored in those interviews.
What are some of the perceptions that students had of coastal life before they started?
Well, that was fun. I actually had them keep journals before we went to the coast and asked them to log some of those preconceptions. And many of them mentioned overfishing, thinking that it was likely that fishers were harming the environment. They were worried about turtles. It was never said explicitly, but there was definitely a sense that they didn't necessarily think they would be the most intelligent folks they had ever worked with. And boy, did they come out of the whole experience completely turned around in all of those expectations.
So you witnessed all that. But, you know, part of what's happening is, like many small-scale operations in our economy, they've been overtaken by large industrial operations. To what extent, Brian, has this happened to fishing?
So when we look at Georgia's fishing community along with others in the U.S., I mean, there's been a number of issues. For one, probably related to shrimp, that's been most significant has been the imports. We now import over 90% of the seafood that we eat in the United States, particularly shrimp, which is the number one type of seafood that Americans eat. That certainly has had taken a toll economically on the prices. It's been hard for our fishermen to compete. Over the decades, though, there's also been a number of regulation changes as well, and which may be necessary for management. But, you know, again, it can have an impact on the fishermen financially. So whether it's where they could fish or the type of gear they could have, As Jennifer alluded to as well, though, the other issue we collectively refer to as graying of the fleet is the fishermen are getting older, the vessels are getting older, the infrastructure to support them, and that's a key part. You can't just have the boats, you've got to have the fish docks, you've got to have the ice houses, the shops for, you know, hardware. Because of that, then we're seeing a lot of the younger fishermen getting out of it. So you've got this collective, just a number of issues that are affecting the ability. Yet, you know, there are fishermen that are still thriving, but just over the years that these socioeconomic factors continue to take the toll.
Where is the importing of shrimp coming from? This is China and Vietnam primarily?
Name it. I mean, Thailand, China, India, around the world. And again, you know, you look 30 years ago, shrimp was, you know, really kind of a specialty item. Now we can get it at every meal. And I mean, it can be from fast food to any restaurant. And, you know, fortunately, you know, more and more people are wanting, recognizing the value of having locally produced food. And, you know, our fisheries are well managed. I mean, they're managed at the state, interstate, and federal level. And that is becoming more and more important to consumers. And that is something that, even though, you know, just number-wise, we can't meet the demand for the growing demand for seafood, that's an advantage for our industry because people are willing to pay more. And that's something that, again, it's unique to our coast that we should be very proud of.
Well, Brian, your office, you're right next to a fishery in Brunswick. How did people working there respond when you approached them asking for their histories, their stories?
What?
Fishermen like to talk about what they do.
Well, I think it's miscommunication a lot of times. And I think Jennifer can allude to this too. I think a lot of times that they feel like they've been misinterpreted or that, you know, they've been painted as quote unquote the bad guys. And when in reality, I mean, their perceptions and their experiences in the water, and many times are in line with what you might hear from a conservation group or managers. But, you know, yeah, there was hesitation. I mean, and I think part of that also aligned with the fear of, you know, how are they, you know, are our voices going to be misinterpreted? But I think once we started doing the interviews, it was amazing to see how the fishermen opened up with the students, and I think it was a learning experience for both sides.
Well, let's hear among the oral histories you collected. Here is a little bit of a couple that fishes together.
You'll see the birds like swoop down on the back, and when they fly up past the wheelhouse, they have a big shrimp in their hand. And he always says, "Oh, we're getting them, we're getting them," because he's always told me from the beginning, "Oh, we're gonna get them." You see that bird? Yeah, because they're getting them.
If you've got birds and they see them shrimp, it don't take but one shrimp to jump on top of the water.
So listening to that, Jennifer, what do you think? You know, Brian mentioned earlier, there's a lot in line with the way that the fishers describe being out on the water with conservation management. These are often posed as opposing forces. What's going on here?
Which is an unfortunate misconception in many cases. Fishermen are often limited by management, and there's obviously often some frustration with regulations that they feel perhaps aren't reflecting the true needs of the environment. You know, and we could talk about that for another 2 hours. But at the end of the day, what we heard in so many of these oral history interviews was a very deep love for the environment and a sense of awe and appreciation and concern about the well-being of the oceans and the creatures in them, and just a real sense of a privilege of being able to be on the water and see these things.
Yeah, as I was listening to them, I was thinking there's almost a kind of spiritual awe. Would they identify it as that?
Absolutely. And in fact, that's another one of the key themes that came out of a lot of the interviews, is a very deep sense of religious faith and belief that they're able to do this because God has put this resource there and that God allows them to do this every day, and being very grateful for that privilege.
That's Georgia Southern Anthropology Professor Jennifer Sweeney Tooks, along with UGA Associate Director of Marine Extension Brian Flick. We're talking about a project that they've been doing, an oral history of fishers along Georgia's coast. Well, what do, you know, if you're talking about this is something God-given, Brian, I want to just push it a little bit, understanding a little bit better the relationship between the regulators and the fishers, which is, again, often at least depicted as an opposition. You heard differently here?
You know, I think it depended on who you talk to. I mean, I think, you know, fishermen recognize that you do need management. And we are fortunate in Georgia, both at the state level and the federal level, that we do have well-managed fisheries. And it's a tough decision because, you know, the people making these decisions have to try to balance the needs of environmental concerns. And they do have to consider that economic and social piece. That's one of the reasons we're doing this project is, you know, we think about sustainability, often it is in the context of environmental, which is certainly important. But to truly be sustainable long term, you can't ignore the economic and social piece. And I think often the social connection is a little hard to wrap your head around. And that's why this is, you know, being able to have these fishermen talk about this as a way of giving their voice to the situation, because that cannot be ignored when it does come to management, because that is all an important piece. So, I that was something that we heard. They, you know, there's frustration because, of course, you know, especially in areas where they used to be able to fish and they can't, of course, they're going to be upset by that, because one thing that the interviews revealed was, it wasn't just that you're taking away, you know, there's a regulation, but that was something they grew up learning. That was their backyard. That was areas where they intimately learned the local environment. And one thing, it's something that's very clear, is their local ecological knowledge is impressive, and it's something that can be a resource, I think, for further helping us sustain our fisheries.
Of course, it's environmental, it's economic, it's communal. Jennifer, give us a sense of how coastal towns are different now than they were at the height of the fishing industry. This is in the 50s and 60s, especially when oystering was big.
They've changed tremendously over that period of time, and this might be more in Brian's wheelhouse, but there's definitely been a huge loss of the infrastructure necessary. There's fewer and fewer docks where commercial fishing boats are allowed to dock. There are fewer fish houses to process the seafood. We don't have any oyster picking houses or crab picking houses on the coast at all anymore. We had one fisher years and years ago on a different project in Liberty County. So, you know, this has always been an emblem of Liberty County, is that shrimp boat on the dock. And now there's not a single dock where shrimp boats can tie up in Liberty County. Mm. And in fact, just recently in Darien, there's been a tremendous loss to the working waterfront in Darien.
How does that change how they relate to each other and think of themselves communally?
Do you want to take that one? Well, I mean, if I could jump in, you're saying a key piece, community. In many cases, the entire community revolved around fishing. So, you know, the fishermen would go to the grocery store, and the people who worked at that grocery store knew that's where some of their sources of income are coming from, or the hardware store. You start taking away one piece, it starts tugging at the rest of the threads in that community. So you've had to adjust. I mean, Jennifer mentioned the crabs. You know, we do not have any more picking houses, so our crabbers now work really more crab to order. And in fact, many of them have become, you know, they're the fishermen and then they're dealers. And in some cases, they're being shipped up to places like Chesapeake Bay where they can get better prices. So the fishermen have had to adapt. I mean, that's one thing. They're very, you know, we often talk about resiliency, but from the fisherman's perspective, I mean, this is their livelihood. This is what they've had to adapt and change the ways that they've operated. And even our shrimpers, you know, they have to be a lot more strategic now when they go out, because they have to consider the prices they're getting or what they might be paying their crew or gas prices. And so you can't just be a fisherman anymore. You've got to be the businessman. You've got to be the marketer. You've got to be the conservationist. And like them or hate them, you've got to engage with management as well.
Speaking of adaptation, there have been a number of studies on how climate change has affected ocean temperatures, oxygen levels in the water, which of course is affecting the population underneath. How is it affecting fisheries and communities, Brian?
Again, how many hours do we have? You know, it's harder to put a pulse on that. But I mean, I mentioned about historical and ecological knowledge. I mean, if you talk to these fishermen, they do see changes and you know, on the waters about maybe when shrimp might show up or you know, when they leave or, you know, other species. So it's harder to necessarily put like one defining factor on that. But it's something that, you know, fishermen and people, I think people in general that work out in the you know, water resources or even farmers, They are often the first to see some of these subtle changes. And you know, politically, they might disagree with terminology that's used, but they definitely, I mean, from our conversations with them, have seen changes. And how that may impact the fishery, I mean, I think that's still to be determined. There might be winners, there might be losers. In some cases, there might not be any changes. It's hard to put a specific, you know, number to that.
Well, we're going to continue our view of the coast with Georgia Southern Anthropology Professor Jennifer Sweeney Tooks is with us, along with UGA Associate Director of Marine Extension Brian Flick. And we're going to listen to Woody Guthrie's Crawdad Song as we're going out. And after the break, we're going to hear their thoughts on some of the challenges and some of the changes in the industry. That's when On Second Thought continues, getting a little bit of a peek of the coast today along Georgia, the islands, with a couple of people who've been researching it and gathering stories.
You get a line, I'll get a pole, babe. You get a line, I'll get a pole. We'll go down the Crawdad Hole, honey, babe of mine.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we are back with Georgia Southern Anthropology Professor Jennifer Sweeney Tooks. She's joining us from Savannah, along with UGA Associate Director of Marine Extension Brian Flick, and they've been working with oral histories, gathering them with students of commercial fishers in coastal Georgia, giving us a view of a population that we don't get a lot of. So this has been fascinating for me. Jennifer, you talked about the infrastructure necessary and boats and boat maintenance being a huge part of the work and expense. Tell us a little bit about the relationship of fishers and their boats. How do they get them?
Many of them are older boats. They've been passed down now for, gosh, since the 60s and 70s, many of these were built. So many of them are older wooden boats that require a lot of care. Many of them are not able to get insurance on these boats anymore. It's very expensive when they're able to procure it. So there's definitely a constant need for maintenance and work. During the interviews, many of them described all the different ways that they need to be prepared to make on-the-fly fixes out on the water. Somebody told us, you know, we can't run to the store and grab that part we need. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely some MacGyvering going on these boats to keep them functional.
MacGyver has nothing on a fisherman.
Right? Well, they're also adapting new technologies. Here's one person from the Oral History Project talking about how high-tech tools are changing things.
Long time ago, we had to have our trees to line up for the sloughs, but now they got computer now with the GPS and stuff, or you could see them, you know, in the boat. Now it's more easier now. Ain't like it was a long time ago. A little baby could shrimp now.
Little baby could shrimp now. So the boats may be old, but they've got new technologies. How are they combining these traditional maps and knowledge that you talked about with technologies like GPS, Brian?
Well, it's funny because depending on who we talk to, some people are not as, you know, in favor of it. I mean, because they did historically rely on that historical knowledge, where some of the younger interviews we had, they're like, we love it. We have Apple computers on board. You know, and these days with, I mean, you can plot your courses and, I mean, you know where all your hangups are to avoid any type of, you know, running aground. You know, with some of the bottom finding machines these days, I mean, that's, you really get a much clearer picture of where you're fishing at. So you're able to combine some of the historical ecological knowledge as well as, you know, just with our ability to, you know, where you're going, where you've been. I mean, that it adds. And I mean, that's also a safety factor, too, of being able to track. So, yeah, some fishermen have embraced that a little bit more than others. And, you know, certainly from the younger generation where we've grown up with so much technology, it's just kind of a second thought to them.
Here's another clip. Jennifer, you did talk to some folks who are hopeful about the future of fishing. Let's hear a little bit more of that audio from the project.
Fishermen are eternal optimists. You know, you got to be. You know, if you're not getting them this drag, well, maybe next drag. If you don't get them today, maybe tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Don't get them tomorrow, maybe next week. If you don't have hope, what do you have? You at least got to have that.
That's the way they've lived for a very long time. Did the people that you spoke to in coastal fishing communities talk about, you know, what has happened to their industry and where they think it's going to go?
Absolutely. And we really approach them with wanting to understand the fishing traditions and fishing futures. And so we would ask them, what is the future of the industry? And the answers were really very mixed in that many people described it literally, quote unquote, as a dying industry and sort of talked about the changes they've seen, especially since what seemed to be this banner year of 1979. They all kept talking about 1979, but sort of seen a decline in the fishery, seen a decline in the infrastructure, seen a decline in the prices that they would receive because of the competition from imported shrimp, but also an increase in gas prices, an increase in ice prices. So all of these things happening simultaneously. So they would describe that to us, but then also tell us the sort of the different ways they saw to go forward with fishing in Georgia, which was to think outside of that same model, to not try to take fishing back to the way that it was in 1979, but instead look for direct marketing opportunities or alternate ways of selling the catch or perhaps downsizing to smaller boats. So they definitely, many of them had some concrete plans as to how fishing could sustain itself nicely in Georgia. And I think it's important to note here as well that when we would finish these interviews and we would hear the bad and the good.
Jennifer, I'm so sorry that we have to wrap. We're running completely out of time, but I want to thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thanks.